and welcome to the Buddha Etc. podcast. Regular listeners may well recall that a while ago now I had a conversation with Robert Boyd where we talked about the Aido and the benefits of practicing the classical arts and some of the things which can be pulled through into modern practice. Well, since then, Robert has been over to Japan for his first kind of proper training trip, and I thought it would be really interesting to people to hear the conversation that we had where he kind of recalls his experiences and talks about some of the lessons learned and also what he brought back to his training upon his return home. So I hope you enjoy the conversation as much as I did. So let's get straight into it.
Well, thanks for doing this. Again, I think I said to you before, the last time we chatted, it turned into and is still the most popular one of the episodes. Now, I hope that's because of the quality of the content and not because people keep re-listening to it to unpick our accents. But it's far and away the most popular chat that we've had. So really good to be able to do a follow-up, but really just kind of see where it goes. But the one thing that I was really interested to hear about was your Japan trip, because it seemed like you had a blast, but you got around a bit as well.
Yeah, we'd seen quite a bit in a short time we were there. I think it was 16 days we were in Japan, mainly in Tokyo, but we managed to squeeze some sightseeing in Kyoto and Nara while we were there as well, which was quite good. The rest of the time we spent training, eating, drinking, the usual Japanese fare. But yeah, it was fun. It was really interesting for me. It was my first time in Japan, and it was my first time meeting my senseis and practitioners in Japan that were fortunate enough to train with. So that was the key thing for me, was to kind of be there and experience that, which was way beyond my expectations. So that was fun. That was real good. Really good.
So how long ago was it that you went? It was about a year ago now, a bit less?
November last year. Yeah, November. The end of November into December. So I think we get back, I think it was first week of December. So late November, early December, we were in Japan where the weather was slightly cooler.
Yeah.
We were warned not to come in summer, which was thankfully not the case, because November alone was very, very humid and still really warm, especially in the dojo. Some sessions were 3-4 hours long. I think the longest one we done was, I think, about a 4 or 5 hour session. That was, the aircon's not great there as well in the dojos. Some of the older buildings don't have the greatest aircon, so that was very interesting to train in that dynamic as well.
Yeah, well, for those that have aircon at all, or heating at all, when it's really cold, it's quite interesting. So was it a group of you that went across? Was it something that you've been planning for a while?
Yeah, so basically, the dojo leaders in our group, our Yaido group, is basically a pilgrimage, if you like, to go and train with our Japanese sensei, who's the head of your group. So that was the key thing, to kind of introduce ourselves, show them exactly what it was we were able to do. And that we were honoring the lineage properly and taking it very serious. As you know, the Japanese, especially with their martial arts, take it very, very serious. So that was to make sure that things were being done correctly, and gladly that was the case. It was just mind blown, to be honest, to actually be in the presence of people that you've heard stories of, or you've maybe seen the odd video and stuff like that. Our head sensei was 88 years old at the time.
Yeah.
So taking in that sort of experience along with the students at his dojo as well, ranged in age, and just experienced that firsthand was absolutely unbelievable. And obviously getting to, for them to put faces to names, if you like, because obviously my sensei here has been sending back and forward, obviously, information and who we are and what we're doing and stuff like that. So it was just really good to actually be there and show that ourselves and have that firsthand knowledge, and also show that we're actually taking what we do very seriously. So I think there was seven, of us went. So dojo leaders from Scotland and England, along with my sensei. And it was just really interesting. Each of us are a completely different character and dynamic, and to be there to show that even with these personal traits and characteristics, that we could still show cohesion in the learning. With Japanese martial arts, especially in Iaido, it's very niche. So making sure that we are doing exactly what it has to be done to maintain a lineage and maintain that the next generation of practitioners, especially in the UK. We're on the other side of the world for Japan. So for them to see that we are actually able to replicate and show what's been shown there, not perfectly, but close enough that things can then keep moving forward. So it was good. It was good news. Sensei there was very happy. He seemed to be quite comfortable in the fact that he'd met people and he could see us and he could judge us with his own eyes rather than relying on someone else's words through email and phone calls, etc. So it was a big deal for everyone as it went. Some of them had been to Japan before. My teacher personally, he lived in Japan for a number of years. Worked in Japan and trained with many, many great Iaido teachers and had that opportunity where they lived there. So he was basically tour guide for us for the whole thing. We relied on him for food reviews and where we were going, what times the trains would be there, what line to get. It was just an all-out experience. The Iaido part for me was the key thing more than anything, and learning first-hand techniques from our Japanese counterparts. But just the culture in general was really breathtaking, and how things are done and how they conduct themselves, and the big differences that you can see as plain as day that you wouldn't think twice of, especially here in the UK. I'd probably seen most Western countries. So that was really, really good.
And it still is incredibly different, isn't it? I'm glad you had a tour guide. It's the first time I went over, I didn't. And
minefield. Absolute minefield.
Yeah.
So I could see.
And I'm a fairly frequent traveller, and it is very difficult to navigate. Just the transport system, which obviously is very efficient, but incredibly difficult to navigate if you're solo. I had a much better experience when I went as part of a pack with people who were much more familiar with the lay of the land. But how did you find, or did you find any major differences in training?
I would say the key thing for me that I noticed was how diligent everything is when you enter a dojo in Japan. Small things that I dare say a lot of dojos outside of Japan can kind of let slip. In Japan, that's not a thing. It's very, very diligent to the rules. It's very diligent to the art. The respect factor for everyone, regardless of grade, etc. It's just there. It doesn't need to be reinforced. Nothing needs to be said. It's just a completely different dynamic as far as I'm concerned. I mean, in my dojo personally, and the dojos that part of our group, we have set rules along with every other dojo and stuff like that. But it's so easy sometimes to skip some things, and if you're maybe late in on the dojo and certain etiquettes maybe not being addressed properly, just it's a different mindset that you need to be able to function better there, because you know yourself. There's a respect system that's really hard not to get caught up in or not to adhere to. It's just there. Especially with Honda Sensei that we were visiting. As I say, 87, 88 years old, just an aura that commanded respect, regardless of if you'd met him before or anything, just how he presented himself, how he moved. There's this, it's hard to explain, it's an aura, but everybody had their own sort of version of that. So I would say there's probably things in, call it the UK, but maybe the West in general, of my own experience, it's definitely a slightly different mindset that's needed. I mean, everybody comes to a dojo for a different reason. I've yet to meet two people with the exact same reason for joining a dojo or why they took up martial arts or anything like that. And some people may have something similar, but everybody's got their own sort of path that led them into the dojo. And everybody's got their own characters. But it seems that Japan, that sort of left at the door.
Yeah.
And it's a very straightforward, focused mindset. And everybody's there to work hard, do what they need to do, attempt to progress, and then have their own sort of stress relief, whatever that may be. They're looking for it at the dojo as well, but I think sometimes what can happen is silly things happen, like a conversation that can suddenly go out of control, and before you know it, 10, 15 minutes of what should have been hard training time is now turned into a conversation that's sort of derailing the practice almost. That's just not a thing that I noticed there at all. Anything that was asked was answered very swiftly with a this is the answer or you don't need the answer sort of mentality.
Yeah, I mean that for me is one of the biggest differences, just the lack of chat or detailed explanation, where you get lots of teachers, instructors in the West who will go to great lengths, won't they, to articulate deep and complex explanations of things. Quite different, more often than not, I'd say, over in Japan, where you get either a very short response, and that's if you get a response at all. And you just expect you to follow the training. You know, that's ultimately what it is, isn't it?
Well, that's the thing, I think, is like even myself at my dojo, I can find sometimes where I attempt to try and explain something and I know definitively what it is I'm trying to explain, but suddenly that starts to snowball as you realise that you've got different grades and different understanding and stuff in front of you, and suddenly you're trying to address everyone rather than the person who asked the question to try and explain things. And then it just eats into practice because you feel that need to kind of almost over-explain to kind of make that point so that you hope everybody's got some level of understanding of what's trying to happen. And it's very hard to break that habit because it's kind of how things happen. I'm quite lucky with my teacher here in the UK. He is really good with his explanations. It will be to the point, and it will be very this is a matter of fact. If it's something other than that, well, there needs to be more explanation. It's usually a phone call or a chat privately outside the dojo between obviously myself or a couple of students who maybe want one answer. And then it doesn't eat into that time where you should physically be training. I mean, a lot of dojo, I mean, we train for 4 hours a week. That's not a lot of time to take in the amount of information that's been passed to people. Something I always say in the dojo to people is if you take one thing from tonight, that's a bonus.
Yeah.
Because sometimes it's just information overload. I didn't find that at all in Japan. The answers were swift. The demonstrations were very specific on what you were to work on. And it was just get on with it and dig in and perform. And obviously there was small parts of feedback being thrown with different like senpai and sensei at the dojo, who obviously are trying to make sure that you're obviously making the most of your trip to Japan. They understand as much as anybody that you've travelled to the other end of the world.
Yeah.
So there was a nice balance in that where some of the other sensei were kind of throwing out small bits of feedback, even sometimes look behind our sensei like waving and kind of trying to show you what to do while you were getting explained. I mean, the trickiest part for me personally is I don't speak Japanese. I understand Iaido terminology,
yeah,
which is great because you can kind of talk the language. But outside that, I don't speak Japanese at all. I know a few greetings and especially learn sorry and how to apologize properly before I went, yeah, just in case I got myself into trouble and had to make a formal apology. Luckily, I didn't have to use that, thankfully. But yeah, it's just a very interesting way of doing things. And I think it's why the Japanese martial arts in general, because I'm assuming all dojo in Japan have the same mentality, regardless of art, whether it be karate, aido, kendo, judo, sumo, for instance, even as well. It's a very specific thing.
I'd say, obviously, I don't have exhaustive experience of all of the arts in all of the locations, but I've seen a range. I've seen a number that have been quite westernized and,
yeah,
I guess quite liberal and less aligned to more traditional values. But in the main, I think you're right. I think that there's just a custom that's been maintained, and it's just, yeah, the way that things are generally approached. How did you find the transition out of the dojo? Because obviously what typically happens is you've got this very functionally fixed kind of approach when you're kind of in the building on the grounds. And then when you see the same people off the mats outside the building socially, you know, usually with a bit of alcohol involved, how did you find that shift?
Well, I mean, to be honest, the main sense we visited inside and outside the dojo, there was that same level of sort of diligence and respect just there instantly.
Yeah.
I remember one night we'd got to the dojo slightly earlier. So a couple of times we were cutting it very close on timing, just due to the travel and getting there. And we were there earlier, and Sensei, it was just a walk from his house, so he'd walked to the dojo, and we happened to be waiting outside, and orderly formed a small queue, and good evening, Sensei, et cetera, et cetera, just formal greetings. And he was quite happy-go-lucky, didn't really speak any English that we know of, didn't speak cousin English, only a very, very few, yeah, terms we got. It was mainly in Japanese, and was having obviously translated for us. Luckily, the dojo there has a couple of Western students who actually live in Japan, so we're translators on tap, thankfully.
Yeah, that helps, doesn't it?
Oh, definitely. It just made so much difference. And even though sometimes you could understand, but there was things that just needed that sort of explanation, which was, if that wasn't there, there would have been things lost in translation. That was a big factor. We didn't, yeah, want that to happen. So we were very lucky that a couple of our dojo brothers there actually live there and very fluent in Japanese and English. Only really spent time with one of our members outside the dojo. And yeah, he very, very laid back gentleman, quite happy, shared a few drinks, had some food. Talked about some Iaido, but mainly it was just a night out with a friend.
Yeah,
that you just met. It felt like you'd known somebody for a long time, and you'd only even known them for a few hours. So it's that sort of family sort of thing in a dojo. By all means, everybody doesn't need to be best friends and socialise, etc., outside a dojo, but there seems to be a sort of closer-knit community in dojos in Japan. And that was really good to see, that sort of side of thing as well, because obviously in the dojo there's a certain etiquette required regardless to who you're speaking to, whether that be a higher rank or a lower rank. And just having that sort of almost the barrier toned down for a bit, just to freely talk about things and not feel like you're breaking rules or you're stepping on toes or you're maybe breaking etiquette. So that was really nice. That was quite fun. We'd met up one night after practice and that was fun. We'd went to a karagi restaurant, a chicken restaurant, which was just in the middle of Adachi City in Tokyo, and just typical nightlife. It was all fun and games. It was good fun. I like to think that these people are only robots, and I think sometimes that can happen, especially if you're doing a martial art and you tend to kind of put people on pedestals.
Yeah.
And assume that they're these bionic beings that don't know how to laugh and have fun and let the hair down almost, you know. And it was good to see that different dynamic to the dojo. I mean, we were out most nights after training, at least for a beer and some food together, as your small group that went there, talking about what we'd learned and what can we do better, and basically just building each other up and supporting each other. If somebody felt that they hadn't had as much from it that day, trying to ask questions to go, well, maybe there's a different way to look at that, or people who had a great day and going, well, that's brilliant, we need to keep up that pace. So we socialised quite regularly as your small group. We also broke up and went a lot. So I spent quite a lot of time in Tokyo just wandering the streets myself. I was staying maybe 10, 15 minutes walk for most of the group. Just bad planning on my part and poor hotel pick. The hotel I stayed in was a small ryokan. It was really nice. It was basic, but it was a bed for the night, and that's really all I needed.
Yeah.
So I spent quite a lot of time checking out Ueno and Asakusa, visiting the Senganen Temple at night time. That was lovely at night time, just relaxing. So it was good to have that sort of social experience with people, and also that sort of single experience where you could explore and almost
take it all in,
different headspace as well, where you could sort of analyse just what's happening, because the first maybe day or two was just your culture shock for me personally, the expanse having silly things like the trains running on time. It's just something that never happens in the UK. Trains are never on time. Taking everything in and being able to sort of analyse this is actually happening. I think we'd done maybe two or three sessions at the dojo, and the dojo there had put on extra hours of training for us, especially. So they had their normal, I think it's two or three nights practice a week. I'm not 100%, I can't remember exactly that they train. But we'd asked for extra sessions, obviously, to fulfill the time when we were there, which they did, which was fantastic. So they were training a lot more than they usually do to accommodate us. And also having to gear up time for their lives to try and make things easier for us, which was really nice to see again, that sort of family level. These people are coming here, sensing me of sent some orders in to get this done, but people were very happy and accommodating, like picking us up from train stations and driving us to the dojo and stuff. But that was really good to have that sort of support network there, kind of granted to us. But the dynamic was pretty tricky to navigate for the first few days, I think, mainly just the culture shock and kind of trying to relax yourself into what it was you were trying to do. I think most days and first day in the dojo, for instance, had just went overkill and trying to do too much, trying to impress.
Yeah.
I remember my sensei had come up and tapped me on the shoulder and said, "Stop trying so hard, you know."
Yeah.
actually makes any sense. I'm really busting my gut here to show what I can do. And it was actually becoming detrimental to my training. So after that first 2 days, things kind of calmed down and you could kind of, excuse the pun, into the swing of things.
Yeah.
Start to analyse exactly what was going on. But it was an experience. I'm hoping to do it again soon, maybe next year, November next year. Hopefully the plan to try and go. Prices have skyrocketed since Japan opened. We were quite lucky and lucky. We booked flights and hotels pre-COVID.
Yeah. Well, you must have been right on the cusp of it opening back up.
They opened two and a half weeks before we flew out.
Yeah.
So we were like really hoping, because it was like non-refundable flights and stuff. Like, that's just really taking it to the cusp. But we looked at this year and it's just astronomical, some of the prices. Even if you can get a reasonable flight, you're still talking £1,000 plus or crazy layover times. And then hotels, etc. Even some of the cheaper places are absolutely skyrocketed in the roof at the moment. So this year, unfortunately, won't be happening. But I'm hoping to return in November next year and further my training in Japan as well. I think that's going to become slightly addictive to try and
it is
try and maintain that, because it's just such a different experience. It's very humbling, and it's also sets that excitement factor, I think, can get lost sometimes. Training week in, week out, same people, same dojo.
Yeah.
It can get kind of, especially teaching, obviously, it can get a bit monotonous sometimes, where you feel like you're just constant repetition, even though you know that's what you've signed up to do.
Yeah.
But that fire can dim slightly. So having that maybe once every 2 years and having that sort of experience again, I think can only maintain my personal level and what I'm doing, but also that of my students as well and our group in the UK, having that connection and keep building that foundation that we laid in November last year.
Yeah, well, you've got the technical connection, haven't you? But you've also got the kind of connection to the heritage of the art as well.
Yeah, definitely. Our dojo, specifically in the dojo we trained in, is a Koryu dojo. So in Japan, for instance, with Iaido, it's ZNKR, so Zen Nihon Kendo Remni, and that's basically the governing body for what you would learn to grade, what you would learn for Taikai competitions, etc. That's the standard set of waza that you learn.
Yeah.
So all dojos in Japan, to some level, have some level of connection there, and so did the dojo we were visiting in Adachi. But it was Koryu. It was specifically, that's what we were there to do, and that's the lineage that we are proud to be part of.
Yeah.
And it was to make sure that we were justifying ourselves to be part of that, justifying ourselves to be able to honour that, the same as the Japanese have done. So that for me was a huge factor in the trip. Was, are we doing this correctly? My sense here is very specific about how this has to be done, and he's super protective of it because it's such a rich heritage to be part of, and it's something I take very seriously in my practice. But it's also making sure that everybody understands what it is they are part of, whether it be for serious, fully committed training or hobby or whatever it is they happen to be doing what we're doing for, that there's still this very serious underlying thing where we're trusted to be part of this long line of heritage and respect that and make sure that that's maintained. And I think that for me, visualising that and seeing that in motion was a huge factor, because as you know yourself, there's many, many dojo in Japan and the West that are just businesses. That's it, they're a business. I mean, Taekwondo, for instance, without getting into too much detail, the money they can generate from that's unbelievable. What we do, it's voluntary.
Yeah.
So we're giving our time and effort to try and show and maintain something that's beyond money. And that was a big thing to see that and being practiced while we were there. Like, we didn't pay to train. We were accepted and just allowed to train. We didn't we weren't ever asked for any money. We didn't have to sort of pay our way in any way, shape, or form. It was just very, very different than what you see in a lot of dojo and all martial arts. Like, yeah. A couple of my friends run karate lessons, etc., and stuff like that as well, and they do it very, very successfully. But sometimes it's not about the mentality of being there and respecting your line, respecting your art. Sometimes it's just to pay the bills.
Yeah.
Sort of idea. And I think that's a big issue in martial arts in general, because it just instantly dilutes any sort of real connection you have to your country origin from it. And that was a thing for us as well. We joked in Japan that we were starting to assume some mannerisms and stuff like that, especially obviously in restaurants and whatever, when you're asking for things or you're thanking waiters and waitresses or the people there. And we laughed at, like, we may become Japanese after this, and we all kind of joke, lad, like, well, I'm Scottish first and Japanese second then, because my English is terrible, let alone my Japanese. What can I do, you know? So it was, for me, it was a massive eye-opening experience all round, and seeing how things should be done.
Yeah.
Or how they should be respected, maybe, is a better word for that. And that's probably my biggest thing I took away. When I came back, my mindset had changed in my own practice, regardless of my students, that what I wanted to do and what I needed to do after having that experience and meeting the people I met, and try to pass that now onto my students and my dojo, and make them understand that there's a bigger thing here than us.
Yeah.
We meet up 4 hours a week and swing swords and learn techniques and whatnot, but there's a part of a bigger thing and a long, long line of people that came before us that maintained a set discipline, a set standard that we also need to maintain as well.
Yeah.
And most of them have accepted that. We've had quite a lot of people coming to the dojo lately, quite a lot of new people. And we've kind of made that the first lesson, is this is what you're part of. Are you happy to be part of that?
Yeah.
Making sure that they know just what they're getting themselves into. And always try and ask people as well, what made you come to Iaido? What made you come to the dojo? And just get a sort of feel for a seriousness in the practice. Do they know anything? Which sometimes is great, because if you're coming through maybe 4 or 5 different martial arts and a new martial art, regardless of what it is, it's detrimental to your training, because your training before is going to start either arguing with what you're being told or
influencing it, yeah.
The opposite thing. So I really like when people go, I don't have any idea. I just seen the advert and I thought it'd be cool. And you're like, okay, that's a great start. That's a great start. I mean, swords are cool. It's the end of the line with me for that. But I mean, that's why I started. I thought swords were cool. I'm going to go and try this and get a shot. And 10 years later, I'm now still doing it, teaching, practicing. And the journey is only really at the start. So it's always fun to watch that sort of blossom, if you like. We do have people that come and it's not for them. It's maybe they'll get a different idea of what it was they wanted to do. And that's fine. But we definitely try and make sure that people have an idea of what it is they're becoming part of.
Yeah.
Yes, it's Iaido. Yes, it's a dojo. But this is our sort of reasons why we practice and we take it serious.
Yeah, I was going to ask actually what you kind of brought back in terms of your practice or training in your own place.
Well, I mean, I've always been very, I was kind of like all in for day one. My first class I attended, it's actually 10 years ago, a couple of weeks ago. Thankfully, Facebook reminded me of that because I made a post and my knees were sore for my first class. And I says to myself, it's 10 years, the knees are worse. They never get any better. It's evolved, especially since coming back from Japan. As I say, I've always took it serious. I've always tried to honour the art, make sure the etiquette's followed properly, making sure that, I joke with the guys at the dojo, I says, if we don't follow etiquette and honour the art, we're pretty much cosplaying the samurai.
Yeah.
That's not really what we're trying to do here. The art and the etiquette is first and foremost. Everything else is technique. That's it. But I definitely come back from Japan, kind of watching how it was done, watching things, small things, like nuances, that I was like, okay, we can bring that back. That can only help your practice. That can only make things more understandable rather than introducing some things a year into training. I was like, this needs to be day one stuff. This needs to be just instilled in students. Silly things like how we start practice, warming up correctly. In Japan, the workout lasted, I think, 35, 40 minutes plus.
Yeah.
And it was like, okay, we do like 5 minutes, 10, maybe. And it's just...
You find yourself really tightening up your reho as well.
Well, that's it. You know, it was... I remember having guys come to the dojo and just coming in and starting straight away and just like, you know what, I'm up slightly. And like, oh, no, I'll be okay. And then maybe 3 weeks later, suddenly there's a case of tennis elbow flaring up or one of these things or another. But like, just things like that.
They take always the knees, isn't
it? Tennis elbow, golf. I didn't know golfer's elbow was a thing until I started doing the idol. I learned that hard way. Didn't know inside and outside could get damaged at the same time. Funnily enough, I just had one of my students actually having that issue. And I said to him, it's power. Power's your enemy.
Yeah.
Let the sword do the work. You're just part of the sword. When we'll try to cut trees into and mountains, people were only that hard. And it's still not going to be like the movies where the guy splits in two and there's this big splatter of blood. It's a slicing weapon that's used to, it's used to cut. An analogy I use in the dojos, if you have a tomato and try and cut it on a chopping board, the way you're using your salt, it's just going to splat across the kitchen.
Yeah.
But if you place it correctly and use the correct technique, you'll slice. But there's a lot of things we brought back, me personally, just things that can enhance the training. Things that can kind of make sure everybody's in the right mindset to begin with. Warming up correctly, making sure the body's warmed up, yes, but making sure what we're doing is actually not just some movements before we start, which for me was kind of the mindset. We're just warming up our muscles so we don't pull muscles, etc. Certain stances having certain meanings because we're going to then replicate these in kata. A lot of the sort of scientific stuff behind it made a lot more sense to me, that what we were doing was grounded in not just, as I say, stretching muscles and that. These are the techniques. This is the foundation of the techniques. If you're not spending half an hour plus doing this stuff, you're not really preparing yourself to really give the technique the respect that it deserves. Lining up in the dojo, how we start practice, how that's done. We've always done it in the traditional Japanese manner, where highest rank to the top, lowest rank to the bottom, sensei, etc., to the front. But yeah, there's a very different way that was done when we were in Japan, because it wasn't the standard way it's done from what we learned before. It was very specific to how it should be, and this is it.
Yeah.
And so we changed our way to how it was done in Japan. Again, to kind of maintain that lineage. If the Japanese do it that way, we do it that way. Mm. That's it. So that was a bit of a sort of a learning curve, especially for some of my senior students who have been doing it a set way for a long time. And it's like, well, this isn't going to be easy, guys, but this is new what we need to get used to doing. So that for me was the big stuff, the reho, the etiquette that needs to be shown beginning and end. Like sometimes I've got a bad habit of class running, no late, but running well, and you're like, right guys, we need to go out. Come on, like just grab your bags and go. And through that, the problem happens then that there's some etiquette gets missed. So you've not really fulfilled the training at that point. And that's something that I've really tried to not make happen since we get back. That really watching the clock, right guys, I'd love to fit another two techniques in, but we need to finish correctly. We won't practice correctly. We end correctly. And that people seem to be enjoying that fact that there's a sort of set structure. And it's not just because it's rules that we've made, it's because it's part of that history and how it's always been done that we're also trying to replicate and maintain that link. It was funny because when I came back, we'd done a lot more core U techniques rather than the basics, the NKR stuff that we were doing. And the guys a couple of weeks ago, we'd thrown in some of the other stuff and they were like, oh, do we need to go doing that again? The choreo stuff is more exciting. I'm like, well, it's more exciting, but the other stuff has its place as well because it's fundamentally about body movements and controlling the salt properly. Mm-hmm. The choreo is also about that, but it is a bit more flamboyant in some places. It there's an excitement to it that's new, and people really like that, and people like the exposure they can gain from learning a technique that's slightly out of the norm, or it may be something they think they've seen before, but then you add the nuance that makes what we do different from the school a couple of miles away who do essentially the same thing, but don't, because the nuance and the lineage that we're part of makes it very, very different. But to the untrained eye, it looks the exact same stuff. So for me, that's a big factor in my training, to make sure like the silliest details that people might think are extremely important things, because it's how it has to be done. So that for me is big part of what we brought back, was this sort of mindset. It's not just Do, it's jutsu.
Mm.
Do is the path, you walk the path, and whatever it is, karate do, iaido, kendo, etc. Jutsu is the real sort of heart of the original techniques, and in some cases, like ourselves, the original techniques that were taught to the samurai, and have survived to the present day through generation after generation, preserving these, what people may regard, as I say, small things, and making sure that they're actually big factors in practice, so that becomes an undiluted as much as possible line. Whereas like any art at all, it can easily start to just go haywire if the small parts aren't properly adhered to and maintained. I think that for me is the biggest factor. Obviously, the training is very different. What we're learning is different from what we were doing, which is tricky at the best of times. So trying to have the right mindset, make sure my training is progressing, make sure my students' training is progressing, and still also challenging for Dan grades and the other style that we practice. So the balance is quite tricky in getting it right. So far, so good. It seems to be working. We're still having people passing grades really well. People are still excited about what we're trying to achieve and what we're doing. And we're still gathering new members who are staying, which is great. So usually
that's one of the things I wanted to ask you about, because you're right. You've got this almost a tension between the... So obviously, what your school is relatively democratized in one sense, because you've got the kind of slightly more modernized, the Aido, broadly open to all if they've got the right mindset and approach and everything else, that you'll invite people in and give them exposure as long as they train and they practice and they're diligent. But then you've got the Koryu aspect, where you've got the deep-seated tradition, which, as you say, taught in a very different way, not the kind of thing that you can have a go at. You're in or you're not, in one sense. How do you kind of balance the fact that you've got both on this continuum in your practice?
Well, when we originally made this sort of transition a few years back to balancing both, it was very tricky because people were comfortable in what they could do and the Aido. And then when you showed them jutsu and tried to explain that slightly different mindset that has to be administered to understand the difference between Do and Jutsu, It was tricky because some people just couldn't grasp the idea, or they felt that it was going to start to dilute what they'd learned. And what they were learning was to pass Dan grades, and that's great. That's goal setting. People love to try and challenge. Some people don't. That's fine. I need to balance both. I still need to attain Dan grades. As the time goes on, I'm a dojo leader. I need to try and keep my obligations to what I can and grow as a leader, and obviously rank in that form helps. And yeah, I don't. Yeah, jutsu, it's not really about rank. It's about understanding. It's about study. And that was the problem. Some of the guys were quite happy in the Aido that you could just be taught this stuff.
Mm.
And by all means, it takes your entire life to learn and no chance to master. But the whole process is to attempt to try and perfect these techniques. But you could buy books. You could watch readily available video online. Trustworthy stuff. Actually, really good stuff actually put out by the ZNKR that you could copy and learn this, and as long as you had somebody fill in the gaps, you could achieve Dan grades in this pretty quickly. Koryu, no, that's very, very different. That drops to level of understanding, it drops to level of commitment, and it drops to, are you willing to teach it?
Yeah, and the gap between Waza and Kata is quite substantial, yeah. There, isn't it?
Yeah, and that's a tricky transition. At Ul Dojo, we teach all your students Koryu, regardless of grade. We give everybody a chance to learn it. At the moment, some are really, really progressing really well for me. They seem to have a different understanding than some others. Some people, they're trying their best and it's maybe no sticking as well as what they would think. But on the other hand, the people who may be struggling slightly are the people who are really excelling in the Do.
Yeah.
They understand what it is they need to do. They've got a good reference on how to achieve that. And that's something they can maintain quite well. The Koryu is very specific on things and how it should be and what it needs to be and what it has to look like. And then, again, you've the nuance of your own certain schools, whether that be the school I train in, all the other schools that exist, there's hundreds in Japan at this point still, and even more throughout Europe. That's tricky. The standard is the standard. Everybody needs to learn the same standard movements. And effectively, you could get most people looking almost exactly the same, regardless of their character or their spiritual vigour or whatever it is they bring to the table. The Koryu's got some allowances for your sort of character to develop itself better and your understanding. And I explained this to some of my students when returning from Japan, that Do is a study as well, but the Jutsu, the Koryu, is a real study.
Yeah.
You don't have reference. You don't have video. It's oral transition. We can't show you pictures because they don't exist. We don't allow video teaching. We don't allow any of these sort of things. You're taught what comes out of my mouth, and what comes out of my mouth is hopefully the same as what's coming out of my sensei's mouth, and is hopefully the same coming out of the Japanese sensei's mouth. And yeah, there's going to be slight differences in how it's approached or it's maybe said, the wording, but the deep-seated meaning, as you say, is there, and the understanding's there. And that's tricky for some people, because what they want is a book. They want reference. They can study at home. And you really only have that 4 hours in the dojo a week to kind of absorb as much as humanly possible.
Yeah.
And it's tricky to balance it. It's tricky to have that, even for myself as a teacher, to teach that, because you're reactive as a teacher. You don't know who's going to show you the dojo. Even in the best of your ability, you try and sort of work out how many people may come, and your regular people that maybe attend one night, or some people that attend all nights at the dojos and stuff like that. But it's really hard as a teacher to sort of have that teaching plan and stick that in place. So sometimes if only my senior students show up, then in the talk, how we're doing things is going to get pretty deep, pretty quick. We're going to try and make sure that things are being transitioned properly, that the understanding's definitely there, so that the other people are watching when I'm maybe not at the dojo or they're there practicing, that they can see, oh, wait, they're doing something slightly different for me. It's the same, but what's different? And then hopefully through that, they can start to answer questions as well as myself. But it's I've been kind of taking Corey on a person-by-person basis, myself personally. You can blanket teach, not a problem. As I say, we teach all students. We go, here's the first kata, etc. We show it, we demonstrate it. But you start to see certain people sort of understand the light bulb moments switching on, and then you can get them maybe slightly more and allow them to then take that on. And that for me was very interesting, because I'd done Zen Kata for 5-6 years. We know Koryu influence. It was just that we trained in. That was our specific thing. And it just became that's what it was. So since introducing the Koryu aspect to my own practice alone, it was like, oh, okay, this is got to be a lot harder than what I assumed. It's not just learning some mere techniques. It's learning the meaning of the technique. No meaning as in where people are and what you're trying to achieve from the kata. It's like there's really deep understandings behind that. And then you have variations of kata as well, which is the same thing but different, because you're changing distance or you're changing the approach of the enemy. And then suddenly just one of the kata you've learned suddenly turns into 10, 12 variations, and you thought, well, I needed to learn maybe 12 before the next set, which has turned into 30 or 40 kata. And then it's remembering, addressing it, and then it's even trickier to teach it, because sometimes you're actually thinking to yourself, am I doing this correctly enough to even introduce this to somebody? So that's the real tricky aspect in the sort of do jutsu sort of thing. The do seems a lot easier to transmit because you've got access to somebody.
Well, the method of transmission, just in terms of senior junior relationships generally, is obviously quite different, but you're right, it's that bit that gets passed across by, I don't know, kind of martial osmosis, I guess. It's quite a difficult thing to describe, isn't it?
It's tricky, because I've had students that react really well to the vocal, so you can talk them through it and they understand it. They're like, okay, understand. Physically can't quite get it, but you can see that they understand what it is they're trying to achieve, and it's going to take practice, which is essentially what it should take. If everybody get every single kata right first time, it'd be pointless. So it's good to see that there's a natural ability to understand that. And there's other people who physically need to see, and it's like stop motion kata. And you're like, I'll demonstrate it. And they're like, stop, I'll actually see. And they'll come in and they'll look at all the minor movements and different pressures in the hands, and that's how they learn. And that's the tricky part, because how do you then maintain a class of, if you're lucky, 15, 20 people, when everybody wants to find a different approach to understand what it is you're trying to say? So I really like the fact that Koryu can be very individual. In that sense, that how you learn can be addressed. I encourage my students at the end of every class, any questions? Most of the time it's no. And you're like, okay, that's interesting. I have questions myself at this point, and I'm confused. So I don't know how you guys can just leave with any questions. And my sensei asks every time as well. I mean, I've been stealing sort of these tidbits from him, and that interest is, do you don't want to ask a question because it's your sensei that's asking, or and then usually what happens is you walk out the door and suddenly this sort of pedestal removes and you're outside the dojo. It's like, I sensei, how does this work? And you're like, I asked 5 minutes ago if anybody had any questions. Like, and then suddenly half an hour, 45 minutes outside the dojo, and you're like, I really need to get home at some point, you know? And it's good though, because they obviously need to ask some questions, but I think in the dojo sometimes it can get a bit, well, I don't really want to ask this in front of people because it could be wrong. But I keep saying to them, look, ask this in the dojo. Wrong is wrong. It doesn't matter. Everything's right. There's no bad questions. There's no silly questions, because there's an answer or there's a teaching point in there for everybody to understand something. And I think in the core you, that's really the core you. You need to ask the silly question that you believe isn't going to be answered, because it could be the golden ticket to get the answer you need.
And it's the classic that almost certainly somebody else in the room is either thinking the same thing or has thought the same thing at some point in the past. And it's
definitely,
I mean, there's a point, I guess, when that just falls away though, isn't it? Because you either get to the point where you're not uncomfortable or worried about, I don't know, making a fool of yourself or anything else. And you can kind of judge whether the question's, I don't know, sufficiently framed respectfully to be able to ask it in the right way.
Yeah.
Or you get those who go the opposite way completely, where you get loads of questions and it's a volley and you just think, okay, well, that's possibly a bit too far the opposite direction.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, that's the tricky bit. If you do ask for questions and suddenly there's like 10 questions, you're like, this is going to take a while. And then sometimes myself, I'm only a fourth dan practitioner. I don't have the answers. I don't have all these magical answers that sometimes people seek. I see myself going home and I'm thinking a question that's been asked me, and I'm phoning my teacher at 10 p.m. at night going, sensei, can you help me with this? I've kind of caught off guard. I don't know how to answer it. And he'll go, oh, but is this? And you go, oh, okay, I never thought you were that. Right, okay, I've got an answer that I can give the student, but at the same time, I'm also analysing, well, how can I make sure that I have answers to some degree rather than just feeling stumped? And that's obviously quite tricky in the teaching part of things. And I think a lot of teachers don't quite maybe own up to that.
No, a lot of teachers would. I mean, it's actually quite a good thing in my view to be able to say, look, I don't know, but I know someone who does, and I'll find out, and we'll kind of explore this together, and we'll bring it back to the next session, because actually that's helpful for everybody. It teaches everybody that make something up. Well, I've had a question. I'm the teacher. I don't actually know the answer to this, so I'll just fabricate something so I don't look bad. That's where you see things really going off the rails, isn't it?
That or the worst part, completely dismissing the student in front of people.
Yeah.
I've seen that happen quite a lot, to be honest, in my time, and it's almost like the person's feeling threatened and have to just almost like dismiss them. An ego more than anything else, rather than just going, you know what, I don't actually know the answer to that, but if you give me a day or a couple of hours, I can get something and hopefully help you. And it's my approach on learning. I believe that not everybody knows the answers. Everybody can't know everything. You have to be able to be humble in this and go, okay, I don't know.
Yeah.
Or if something I always point out in the dojo with the guys that I train with, and I say to them, like, if you see me teach something but then not do it, point to it. Like, by all means, like, you don't need to like grind everything a halt and kind of make a big show yet, but you merely have to
call you out mid-session,
Well, sensei, can I speak to you or something? And you go, or whatever, outside, like, Robert, you've got a second guy. Well, I noticed during that you, and I'm like, all right, thanks, that's helped my training. Thank you. We're learning this together. Yeah. I just have to be a couple of steps ahead in the path. It doesn't mean I'm I'm untouchable and I can't understand things and I can't make mistakes. Like, we have a laugh in the dojo quite a lot. One of my students always points out the same thing, and it's going to the point where it's a recurrent thing, but I'm like, it's just bad habit. I can't help it. I've got really crap posture. It's terrible. It's no great. And I do my best to fix it. And my sense is always like shouting random things. And I'm like, okay. And I know sometimes I don't quite hear what it is, but I know it means my posture, and I'll go, yeah, fix it. And suddenly it's, yeah, overkill, because now I'm straighter than any human beings I've been in my life. But one of my senior students always goes like, and just kind of points, and I know exactly what it means, like my chin's down or something, and I'm trying to maintain that. And it is just sheer practice and trying to maintain that. And I think that's a healthy relationship for all practitioners to be able to sort of point out to some degree, regardless of rank and whatever, that you can be humble in the fact that we're all learning this at the same time. Some of you may be ahead of others, but doesn't it mean that everybody's information or studies invalid just because you hold a higher rank or a place in a dojo that deems you sort of untouchable to any sort of criticism or being taught by your students? I've learned more from teaching than I have from doing.
Yeah.
And that was a tricky thing for me, because I felt like something was wrong when I was teaching and I was suddenly learning these things that I thought I should already know. And it's, you have to overanalyze yourself as a teacher to be able to go, okay, well, I'm asking this for these group of people, but am I physically showing this stuff? Or what is the situation here? So I always encourage people that what you'd said doesn't match what you've done. I can go, okay, is this better? And they go, yep, or no, which is sometimes the common answer. And I'm like, right, okay, I'll come back to you. I need to go and fix this, and I'll come back and I'll show you that it can be done. Because when you're demonstrating slow motion or sort of stop motion level teaching, it's very easy to find yourself in the correct positions every time. But when you start doing it in real life motion, mistakes are...
Yeah.
There's a level of laziness to every person, unfortunately, and sometimes that catches you, especially when you're in front of maybe 10, 15 people who's watching eagle-eyed on every movement you make. You suddenly get caught off guard. But I'm very humble in the fact that I like that to be pointed out. I mean, there's a time and a way to do that that doesn't become disrespectful or put you in a situation where it's really awkward for the room. But no, definitely, learning has to be done by everybody. And if I have a guy that started 4 or 5 sessions ago suddenly pointing out that my cut's terrible, then I'm starting to wonder is he making this up, or is he listening to me and learn correctly to the point that I'm actually not doing this correctly? And then there's a good conversation there.
Those early beginner students, I've always found are the very best for feedback, because they hear very literally, and you get it played back to you straight away. And obviously, as people progress, they kind of fall into step with you, and. Yep. It's that perspective, isn't it? They can't see it because they're so close to it. Whereas someone who's brand new or comes back to it after a period, suddenly it's there. Well, hang on, you're telling me to do this. One of the things for me was always, I used to cuss, and I used to, especially in Jodo, just bring over the head like I was chopping wood. So there was no extension, there's no kind of elliptical movement, and yet I'd be saying, no, you have to, the cut, because obviously
you have to cut correctly, and it affects the technique, and not just you.
I could see people sort of looking at me going, well, the words that you're saying aren't actually matching the actions that you're doing. You've got to go away and just have a word with yourself at that point, haven't you?
Oh, definitely. And to say, I think that's an important thing for any practitioner. Like, I've seen students at seminars and stuff like that, like, get feedback from a teacher or even somebody next to them who's trying to be very helpful and pointing something out, and I'm getting really irritated to the point of anger about it. Like, okay, right, maybe you don't want to accept that, which is fine, but like, why would this maybe complete stranger to you be pointing something out that's so straight to the point? Why would they need to lie? And as you say, with beginners, you don't, there's no filter involved. It's just, it's there.
Yeah.
And if they're trying to learn correctly, and they, as you say, they're very quick to learn this stuff and listen. Physically, they might not be able to do it, but they're taking in every ounce information, because that excitement's there at the start with a lot of people. And I think that thing where they kind of fall into step is just through, maybe that fire's not the same as when they come in. I mean, the first time in the dojo is always exciting for everybody, or terrifying, or both. It just depends what sort of dojo you happen to have walked into. But I think that sort of spark diminishes slightly, and they're maybe not as comfortable just starting that conversation. And sometimes as well, they're not that comfortable receiving feedback, because they believe what they're doing's super correct, and that's just how they've achieved their technique, and that's what they think is how it should be done. And that's always a tricky thing, especially after passing a grading. As soon as somebody passes a grading, you've got that excitement, that pride in themselves that they've passed it. But then as a teacher, you need to then go, okay, that was really, really good. Very happy with that.
Yeah.
Here's some feedback on the grading. No, unfortunately, we need to destroy you and rebuild you with the steps needed for the next grade. And I've always found that's the hardest part for most students, especially in feedback, is that you've built them up to this sort of physical and emotional state that they, if all goes to plan, they're going to pass their grading. They're going to have that sort of emotional, the happiness, the nerves, this whole circus of stuff happening. And then they receive their grade and you're like, brilliant. And you have the honeymoon period, I like to call it, a couple of weeks where they grow into their grade.
Yeah.
And then your training starts for the next grade. And sometimes that's not that easy to be told, okay, that was really great for that grade, but next grade, okay, there's a lot of work needed. And I found there's a lot of people, that's when they hit that stumbling block of leaving a dojo.
New Dan syndrome, as I call it, is an interesting phase, isn't it?
And especially the higher you go, because the ego builds. And that's the tricky bit about martial arts, that ego building. And there needs to be a level of ego in martial arts, especially at a teaching side, because you need to be charismatic. You need to be a leader. You need to be showing people that I'm worthwhile following.
Hmm.
And it's no cult level ego, but I've seen that happen as well with quite a lot, you know, that sort of cultish sort of egotistical leader who just demands, this is that how it's done, and you watch their dojos just diminish to nothing. But you still need to have some level of ego as a teacher, but you also need to check that. And I think having that feedback for like people who walked in the door 5 minutes ago are suddenly telling you your technique's no great. And if you just dismiss that, and or worse, tell them to leave because you feel hurt by that, and you're not analysing that and saying, well, they don't know nothing about what we're doing apart from what I've told them, and they're telling me it's wrong. That's a problem for me. I need to fix that. And I think that, again, can happen, obviously, with the new Dan syndrome, like you're saying. Like, there's a very comfortable things took place. There's a lot of emotion involved in it. But then having to then, again, just kick that sort of stool from under them and go, okay, right, you've passed it.
Yeah.
Here's the next step. This is going to be tricky. This is what we need to achieve. And that for me as a teacher is quite tricky, because you don't know, you need to find that happy space where you sort of transition from allowing them to be that grade that they've achieved, but start building towards the next one. Especially as you go through into the higher levels, like I've got a few students at the moment who are third dan, who are eligible soon, and scattered right through from second dan right down to the bottom. And you're trying to find that place to try and make sure each grade has what they need to get there, and making sure that they're not putting too much on themselves as well.
Yeah.
So I've always tried to explain the grades how I've understood them myself through past them. This is what's achievable. This is what you should be able to show. And I try and train them to slightly above that.
Yeah.
And I've always said, if we train at a level above, if you have a bad day, you'll be that level that you're trying to achieve. But if you have a good day, you're going to be setting some standards on the floor. And unfortunately, how on there we sure are terrified of grading, you want the judging panel to be watching you.
Yeah.
You want that limelight.
Yeah, I mean that's something which I've always carried through in my own training. Yeah, this notion that you don't rise to the occasion, you rise to the level of your training. It's absolutely true. It's true, exactly. Irrespective of art or style or school.
Yeah, definitely. And I think that's a mindset people need to adopt very quickly if they're going to achieve any sort of progress, whether that's gradings or just moving through years of training and try to achieve something from it.
Yeah.
Whether it's social, hobby, or seriously committed training, whatever that may be. But if I've always been a person where if I'm not progressing in something, then why am I wasting this other person's time?
Yeah.
Because as far as I'm concerned, if somebody's trying to teach me something and I don't really want to progress, or I feel like I'm progressing, I feel like I'm starting to waste their time. And then it becomes about them and not you. So I've always been a very big advocate in my own training that I should be attempting to either achieve new Dan grades, or I should be able to go, okay, this week, heart maybe not have been in practice as much as it should have. Let's try harder the next session. And then, as you know, everybody's lives are different and the trials and tribulations you go through on a daily basis. So you don't always come into the dojo with the clearest mindset. Yeah. Sometimes you can't even, you're not interested, you can't be bald. You don't want to be there. You'd rather be at home, beer in hand, TV on, whatever the case, especially on nice sunny days. Barbecue days are always a hassle at the dojo.
Yeah.
They're always the lowest numbers. And I get that, and I understand that, but like, I always feel like you need to try and keep pushing and keep pushing for that progress factor, because somebody somewhere has gave you this chance to sort of excel and be better at what you're trying to achieve. Martial arts, schooling, whatever it may be, day-to-day life.
Well, I mean, that goes back to your point about the training in Japan, though, doesn't it, where you've got the things really struck me first time was, and I know logically it was never true, but you imagine you've got these hardcore practitioners who spend every waking hour every day at it in the training hall, in the dojo. And obviously these are just regular people who have got regular jobs who are, you know, coming along to train after doing hard day's work or family life or whatever else. But if they've gone out of their way, either because they've been encouraged to or told to or otherwise, and put themselves out to give you extra training time to help you not get lost in the machine that is kind of Tokyo and suburbs, and help you through the training, then you do kind of owe it to them in a big way to invest yourself fully.
Definitely. I mean, that's obviously where the Japanese term giri comes from, that duty.
Yeah.
And that was a big thing for me coming back to Japan. Like, okay, now I really understand what that means. I knew what it meant because I'd done some reading and research into different terminologies that I was really interested in. But that became a real thing on my return to Japan. Okay, we're no samurai. We're Western people who happen to be there in Japanese martial art. That's great. I'm no under the illusion that that's what I'm trying to achieve. But like the giri factor, I was like, okay, there's a level of duty here that people are showing to me that I don't know if I deserve. You know, that way you're the outsider in their world, and yet still you're getting shown that same sort of level of respect and or loyalty or whatever it may be that they show the people I've known maybe all our lives and stuff like that. And that's very different here. There's some great people you'll meet. There are a lot of great people you'll meet who just kind of instantly just gel with you, or they'll conversate, or they'll treat you just like a human being. But there's a lot more who won't.
Yeah. But I mean, most people over in the West tend to see giri as some kind of quid pro quo, as opposed to actually, no, like you say, deep-seated, really difficult to describe, but you know, that appreciation of, well, actually this person's done this. I don't have an obligation, but I have a real sense of obligation.
Yes, that's the tricky part, is where that goes to an extreme, where the obligation becomes cultish.
Yeah.
And that's a tricky part, because by all means, we have leaders and whatever it is, and sensei in our lives that we'll look up to and become friends with, and brothers, sisters, family at some point it can happen. But there's a fine line between having an obligation and feeling that an obligation has to be adhered to at all times. And that's tricky, because some people don't quite see the divide, and how the divide is complete opposites on both sides of that coin. Because I say in Japan, it was just kind of there.
Yeah.
And it was like, do you guys need a lift to the train station? No, we'll get the bus. No, don't go out your way. It's fine. No. What train station you got to? And you're like, okay, he's not going to take no for an answer. Let's just get to the closest train station. And if we need to make it anywhere there, that's fine. We don't want to put you out basically. But it was just a given. It was there. It was happening. And it was just part of what the culture demanded. It didn't feel like they were being forced to. Mm. It didn't feel like MD had made specific arrangements for that to happen. It just felt very natural.
Yeah.
And as you say, Giri here can be forced. It can be used against you. It can be used as a weapon, a tool to control.
Yeah.
And that's not how it is in Japan. That's very different from what I've seen. I mean, I dare say it can be used like that in Japan. I wouldn't say it won't be used like that. But I think what I experienced was just a genuine use of that, what it should be.
It's a really fine line as well. Some of it, as you say, is it's cultural, and it's just custom, and it's the kind of inherent politeness and respect of the way of going about life over there.
Yeah,
but typically in the martial arts, there's something else which sits above that, and as you say, done well, then it doesn't descend into to cultishness or anything else. But also, the vast majority of people that practice are hobbyists. What, less than 1% of people who train in say Europe will make their way to Japan. Less than that, even more so, more than once. Most people just do it because they enjoy learning a new skill, gives them discipline, whatever their reason for training. But then you get this someone who's committed enough to organize themselves individually or as part of a group to go to the other side of the world in a culture and a language with a transport system that is nothing like over in the West, and do that because they have a genuine desire to go and experience something closer to the source or to improve themselves. Yeah, I think appreciating what that is you do find that naturally received in a way that you possibly don't so much culturally over in the West.
No, I mean, like, I've visited a lot of dojos in UK, and I've trained at big seminars in Europe and stuff, but and it's very welcoming.
Mm.
It's really nice. There's a great atmosphere. Yeah. Everybody kind of rooting for each other. Even in Taikai competitions, the people you're fighting against are still like rooting for you to win, and you're kind of caught up in that, and you're like, no, but I hope you win. And suddenly there's sort of mid-argument about, well, you should beat me and I should beat, and it's fun and it's nice and it's a really welcoming atmosphere. But it's no cultural, it's just genuine people speak to genuine people. It's just a really nice human interaction. But as you say, when you're in Japan, it's cultural. It's part of how these people are. And obviously, like, I mean, I think what a lot of people can get caught up in when there's that sort of either love for the culture or the arts or of another country that you're no origin to, that you can sort of be seen as like sort of, this place is infallible. New Japan is its own massive issues and a lot of factors in it, and it's governing government and its systems and its cultures, and the same as any other country in the world. But they just seemed to have a very human aspect about how they respect each other. Like silly things, like we did quite a late night one night, and I remember walking back to my hotel, and it was like something like 3 or 4 in the morning. It was about a rough night. Fun night, a lot of peach and plum wine and beers. It was nice. Walked by my hotel 3 times before I Google Maps finally told me you're here, and then I found it. But I'd noticed that the bin collection men were emptying the street bins, and they were emptying obviously the local bins. Not a noise.
Yeah.
Not a noise. Like dead silent. I remember standing specifically for a couple of minutes watching bin men emptying bins. And it was as small amount of noise as possible to make, not to disturb people in the neighbourhood. A level of respect and sort of cultural identity that I think a lot of you don't quite have anymore, or ever had sometimes on occasion. But that for me in Japan, like the streets were clean. People were outside their own houses cleaning the streets, as well as obviously the services that are employed to do that. But everybody had that sort of little bit of pride in their own place in the world. And I'd asked a lady directions actually as well, and she almost went out of her way to take me to where I was meant to be. And I was like, okay, that's fine. Just wearing a very broken English Japanese conversation, but she made sure that I was going to be where I was. And all I could think is, like, is she going to be late for work? And you know, like most people, when you know, I mean, I've done it as a kid. How do you get here and you go, ah, go that way? And suddenly the guy's 6 miles in the opposite direction just for a laugh. It just seems like they had a certain level of duty.
No, I agree.
Very human about things and as helpful as possible. And you, obviously, you're a foreigner on your land, and you do get the odd stare on a train when you're seated and they're not, and you kind of feel like I need to get up because I'm really annoying people here, that I don't feel like I deserve this sort of seat in the train. This older lady is staring through my soul. And there's things you have to kind of manoeuvre as in any country you visit, Japan, wherever it may be, that there's cultural things that just happen that we don't sometimes adhere to. And then seeing that translated into the arts and the dojo and stuff like as well, it was like elevated to a certain level where then that the word Reiho made extra sense.
Yeah.
Because they've got a very basic Reiho that they administer during the day, whether it be serving customers in a shop, whether it be bus conductors, etc. Everybody's got a place and a time and how they do things, and there's a certain Reiho to that. When you get into the dojo, you really start to understand, like, okay,
this it levels up quite a bit, doesn't it?
This is why this is so important. It's not just bowing to the sword. It's not just 5 minutes before you get to practice. It's really meaningful.
Yeah.
And then it becomes very personal to you if you then see that, because it's not just another movement to get closer to practicing. It's a very meaningful thing for you to actually adhere to so that your practice is as pure and as focused as it possibly can. And that was interesting to sort of watch that sort of dynamic and how it's done throughout my trip. And then noticing cultural differences, for instance, like when I was in Kyoto, it was slightly different than Tokyo. Tokyo was very hustle and bustle. We were staying near Ueno, which is just zero for businesses and stuff like that. So busy. Nothing like Shibuya or Shinjuku and stuff like that, but it was busy. People were going about their daily life and getting things done. But when you went to Kyoto, even we stayed obviously in the main part, like the actual modern city, and visited obviously the more traditional parts and some of the temples, etc. But even in the city, it just seems slightly more laid back, and it was a different culture again. It wasn't like you could go to any city in the UK and there's a very similar culture happening. Maybe some exceptions to maybe historical places like in Wales or Edinburgh or other smaller parts of England where there's slightly different cultural things happening. But for it to move like 2.5, 3 hours, whatever it was, the Shinkansen, and it was just night and day culture.
Yeah.
It was was a big shock to see, okay, this is like a whole different country or something.
Yeah, and it's not that far. Did you go kind of across the centre of the country from east to west, or did you follow the main roads? Did you go into kind of Seki and places like that?
We went down through Seki and stuff, and we visited, we were in Gifu for a day. We were picking up some kit from one of the suppliers there, so we had a really nice day in Gifu and near Seki. We visited like the Japanese Sword Museum and stuff like that, and had a really fun day buying swords.
That's quite a different feel to Tokyo. That's not the same as wandering around Narita for 5 hours trying to find an exit, is it?
Yeah, very, very different. Very different. Because Gifu was nice because it was very country.
Yeah.
Very, very country. Something I noticed as well is you noticed where the money and sort of poverty line started transitioning. We noticed that on the train. My teacher pointed that out because he stayed near Gifu for a long, long time. And he said, watch for when the money starts disappearing. And you started to notice it getting really big, or houses and populated areas. And it's, I wouldn't say slums, but more country, traditional level sort of Japanese houses into the farmlands and stuff, and you could see a really clear transition.
A lot more of that happening.
So that was like another thing. Like we were on a train and we're suddenly learning what we're seeing, or what most tourists may see, the Japan people want to see, and then real Japan, where it's not all skyscrapers and neon lights. And so that was really good to see that as well. So we were in Gifu and we passed through, we were in Seki. As I say, we were picking up equipment in Seki when we were there. Got to meet some of the craftsmen who make the sword and stuff. But that was great for me. I'm very much into Japanese swords in general. So that was really good to kind of be there and sort of the heart of where it began and where it still functionally happens day to day. We went to Kyoto. We spent 2 days Kyoto, 1 day Nara. Nara was really fun. We'd done really just tourist stuff in Nara. Mm. Go and feed the deals, get chased by the deals, get headbutted by the deals. So that we'd done that purely because a couple of us didn't really want to do it, but like me and a couple of other guys, like, we really need to go and feed the deals.
Yeah.
I don't know if it's some sort of complex I've developed, but I really need a deer to bout me for a cookie. I may as well be a tourist to some degree, but here, highly committed to a martial art, I think a deer should bout me at this point. So that was fun, doing that sort of relaxed tourist sort of stuff as well. Yeah. And we visited quite a few of the temples and, we visited the, I can't remember the name of the temples, but in my head, I mean, the giant Buddha in Nara, at Nara Park. That was astonishing to just witness something so big encased inside a building, but still have this intricate level of craftsmanship and art and every detail of the building. And again, there was like school kids there and there was like full on, like must have been during school hours because there was like lines and lines of school kids and they had their matching t-shirts and matching hats and you could tell different schools and different grades. Mm. And I was just like, it's so well organised how it was done. We actually had some Japanese kids saying hello to us. I think we were waiting when we were guys coming from, I think he was buying something for one of the shrine stalls. And the kids were saying hello and asking where we were from and stuff like that. And it was really nice to see them sort of trying to learn English from us.
Practicing their English,
It was really cool. And my teacher, he'd explained to me they're actually encouraged to do that because it helps them build the bridges and learn different things. So we were telling them from Scotland and a couple of guys from England were telling them parts of England they were from and stuff like that. And it was just a genuine, really nice encounter with people. So that again was another factor of the culture that was really enhancing why we were there.
Yeah.
And even news, I come back, like I'm sort of instilling silly things in my kids and stuff that I've seen there that I'm thinking, like, you know, that's not a bad thing to be as polite as you can be to people. Mm. And obviously there's the dangers of life and what you need to avoid, but like, just try and be a decent human as much as possible. Sometimes that's impossible, but try and be as good as you can be to people. Yeah. Like, I always say to them when I met the little kids, it was such a pure thing. Because they were just like, hi, and you were like, okay, hi. And then the teacher was sort of like watching, but kind of letting them do their own thing. Yeah. And I really, my teacher was also, he was talking to me in Japanese, which they were astounded at.
Oh, yeah.
A long conversation.
That is never expected, is it?
No, and he was asking where they live, and oh, I know that area and stuff. And you could see their eyes were huge with excitement that's 6 foot plus tall Western man was speaking Japanese to them and understood like where they lived and stuff. And it was really fun to watch that happen. But we've fitted in the touristy stuff as well, you know.
I think you've got to. It's a long way to go not to pick up some trinkets and do some tourist
The shopping different stuff. That's, you need to buy some stuff. I mean, yeah. I had to restrain myself for a period of time.
well, that's probably. I was determined that I was going to get us in on an hour, and it was never going to happen, was it? But I reckon that's probably a good place to wrap up. So,
yeah.
Final question: did you buy any swords when you were over there?
I bought an Iaito. I bought a new sword.
I knew it.
I've had to buy one. We'd actually went to Noshudo, run by Igarashi-san, and he actually gave us a tour of his facility and gave us a tour of the Seki Sword Museum and treated us to a really nice lunch when we were there. And so I purchased a new Iaito. My teacher's been telling me for a long time to buy a sword from there and have it sort of like specifically sized and stuff.
Yeah.
And I've always just kind of been like, I can get one in the UK tomorrow, next day delivery and whatnot, and just being stubborn. So I bought my custom sword there, which is fantastic. That's perfect. It does the job that it's meant to do. And the service we were gave was top class. It was just every detail that we needed was met and done properly. Restrained myself from buying some antique swords because I'd seen them quite early in my trip, and I thought, I can't bankrupt myself at this point. I did maintain some money. Seen some really, really nice things. But I'd picked that up. I'd done a bit of shopping, picking up small trinkets for the family and stuff. But I was determined not to come back. But then I came back and I've ordered my Shinken, my sword to be made in Japan as well. So that order's placed for my sharp sword to be made, which I'll need later in my training. Not much later in my training. So that's ordered and purchased, and that's a big step in my training to make that sort of leap from using what's essentially a blunt sword and very easy to make mistakes with and not get injured to something that can potentially move some fingers very quickly if you're not paying that much attention. So, I mean, that was post-holiday, though. That was post-coming back. But that when I was there, I was like, I need to order my sword now. I really need to order my sword. And Igarashi-san slipped me some catalogues as well, which wasn't helping. That was the only sword that I'd picked up this time.
I thought there might be at least one.
Oh, there had to be one. There wouldn't have been a trip to Japan always.
Absolutely. Well, listen, let's call it a night there, but
yeah, no problem.
Thank you so much. I could just chat for hours and hours, but that's been really, really brilliant. Hopefully not the last time as well, and we'll pick up some other stuff next time, but really appreciate it.
No problem at all, Craig. It's always a pleasure. Thank you again for having me on.